impedance readings or stray voltage readings are now a lot higher, meaning that my ohmmeter is now jumping from, let's say, 2 ohms to 50 ohms, 60 ohms, 70 ohms. It's going all over the place, plus or minus. And by the way, plus or minus is another point which was interesting, because if there was a location where I reversed my ohmmeter leads and I saw a steady negative number. That gave me the clue that this is some DC component that's coming down the cable, the radiax, or in this case heliax, into the room. There was no other place where I could see this entering the room, but again, I did not disconnect anything to check this. Now this is this becomes now something that, as far as tunnel work is concerned, would have to be investigated to see. I'm kind of curious myself how this is getting into the...
Repeater, time out.
Let me get the beeps.
Quick comment, Andy.
I have a question for you, Andy.
Okay, I got a quick comment, then I got a question. Okay. I'm going to give it to Dick as the moderator, and then he'll pass it around. But I would like to know for my own edification where this is getting in and how it's getting in. By the way, there was a report which I found on the internet, which is labeled straight current corrosion in electrical rail systems. And this report was done in 1995, and it actually mentions besides New York City, it mentions other states and other rail systems, as for instance, Metro North and San Francisco Bay Area Rapid Transit, and so on. So this thing that we're seeing is not something new. It's been around a long time. It's just that we uncovered it because of this grounding issue, which is required by transit to make sure that our system, our radio system, is grounded the way it's supposed to be. So when I saw this, that's when I realized that it's not a ground issue per se, but a straight current issue, and that's what was going on with that. I think I mentioned everything right now. Dick, back to you for any other comments, and then pass it around. WHCDL.
Yeah, there's quite a number of subjects that I know that Bob AXV is going to want to clear up on this particular set of issues. WA2AXV, K2LIW. Take your time and go right ahead, Bob. And you only have to wait for the beeps. You don't have to wait for the machine to drop.
Okay, I promise. WA2AXV. You see, Andy said a dirty word. He said the structure ground. And again, there's a difference between structure ground and an earth, a true earth, and a water pipe ground. So it tells me that things are not really grounded the way they think they should be grounded in the communication rooms. I talked to Andy the other day, and I told him, Andy, get a pencil and paper out, and I want you to call up my system operator's desk, 212-424-4711. Again, 212-424-4711. Speak to the superintendent on the desk and ask to get connected to Serge. Serge Philippou. I explained how to spell his name the other day. Serge. He was the engineer in charge of corrosion control. And we have a set of interesting instruments. We have direct current amp probes and all sorts of nice little torches that you make an arrangement with him to come out, and you'll get a definitive answer as to, are you grounded, are you not grounded, was there a mistake made, or do we have a problem brewing? So that's what I'm going to tell you to do. Give Serge a call, and he'll fill your head with all sorts of interesting stuff. Go ahead.
All right, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, because the radiax cable, which in the tunnel couples to heliax cable, which we're going to call the heliax jumper, and the heliax jumper goes to a bulkhead on the equipment cabinet that's in the station, in the equipment room of each individual station. and let me just pick numbers out of the air. Let's assume that I've got two stations that are 2 miles apart. So therefore, I've got essentially 2 miles of Radiax cable grounded at the equipment cabinet on station A and 2 miles away at station B. Because thousands of amperes are being pumped into the system by the MTA power supplies. Let me drop. And you've got Con Ed and Loco, but you've got Con Ed pumping thousands, tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of amperes of current into local ground because of other power systems. Some of those power systems are closer to station A or closer to station B. I am speculating the possibility exists that the absolute voltage of Earth at station A, assuming it's got perfect water pipe grounding, and the absolute voltage at station B with perfect water pipe grounding, there could be some number of millivolts of difference between those two Earth grounds because of what Con Ed and MTA and other organizations are doing, because there's all kinds of current being pumped into the ground, and therefore those so-called grounds could be above the core of Mother Earth. That's a speculation on my part. I wonder if anyone has ever said words similar to that, Bob. W-A-2-A-X-Z, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, A2AXZ here. You know, that's been the bane of transit operations for years, because long routes cables, and it comes back on the shields. We have power cables that actually have shields too, and our power cables are coated in lead, and the lead starts heating up because we go these long distances and there's taps along the way providing a current flow. And it doesn't matter if they're AC or DC. All it takes is a current flow to eat up the cables and, of course, give you elevated readings. Yep. Again, give Serge a call. Get in contact with his group. And I'm sure that together you'll find out the true reason of what's going on out there.
Here, Jack. Yeah, let me pick up the order now. Rich N2EO earlier wanted to make a question, so we're going to go to Rich N2EO and then Eric KE2EJ in that order. Rich N2EO, go right ahead with your clarification on this subject. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick. The whole thing is very interesting. You know, back in the, I guess the early 70s, and I guess, Bob, there was something called on the number 7 line, which I used to take from Flushing to the city. It was called the Super Express. It made one or two stops and went right into the city. Whatever happened to that thing? I don't use subways anymore. I'm out of Long Island, but I'd like to know. And how come we've never gone in this country to modern high-speed rails? I'm going to take a guess and say just too expensive. Back to net.
To B2AXE, you got it, Bob. K2RIW.
It's funny, but you're right about that. It's just way too expensive. What we do is we have an upper management in transit, and every time you sneeze, there's new presidents, new vice presidents, people coming and going as fast as you can change your underwear. And each one has their own philosophy of how they want to run the trains. Sometimes they run the Super Express. Hey, we had a Super Express on the F train once upon a time, and that one disappeared too. It just depends on passenger loading, usage. And back in the old days, we only had a 2-track railroad. When they opened up with a 3-track railroad, that gave us the ability of running an express. Sadly, it's only in one direction. Anytime they build a new subway, like the Second Avenue subway, and I was involved with the engineering of that, all of us protested nine ways to Sunday. We didn't want a two-track railroad. We wanted a three-track railroad. Well, now we've got a two-track railroad, and what does that mean? That when the Second Avenue subway finally comes into operation, you've got a hell of a long run from 125th Street to Wall Street. Local stops all the way, no express. Everything is money and everything is operational philosophy, good.
And each time there's a new administration, some of these philosophies change. I can see how the people working there, like you worked there for 40 years, I'm sure you experienced quite a number of changes where people would say, they would come to you as the old man of the organization, so to speak, somebody who's been around a while, saying, Bob, how in the world can we tolerate this? This new guy comes in with his fancy ideas, and he thinks he's going to change the way we do things. I got a question, Bob. Back in the days when it was a pure DC system, before the new brushless AC motors were installed with their corresponding electronics, excitation electronics, I'm going to call it, and when you go from series to start and then parallel to run, and 650 volts is the maximum volt that you have between third rail and negative rail, in the parallel mode with the motor, with no resistance, you shunted out all the resistance, now 650 volts is going to a direct parallel motor. That motor is trying to act as a constant velocity device. As such, there is some very fixed miles per hour, I am guessing, that the subway car would run at. Roughly how many miles per hour was the fixed number, 650 volts, motors running parallel with the old DC system? W2AXZ, K2LIW, go ahead, Bob.
Back in the olden days, when we had the BMT standards, the triplexes, and the other cars of that type, you were able to do 60 to 70 miles an hour. Transit got into a lot of trouble maybe 30 years ago when we had a big accident on the Williamsburg Bridge. And they found out that we were running the older cars, and unfortunately we've upgraded the power system because the old cars were made to run on 550 volts. Along comes these newfangled rectifiers that put out 625, 650, and the trains were going too fast. They actually had to modify the shunts inside the motors to, instead of having just a full series field, they went to a parallel field, a simple shunt field, and it would actually slow the trains down somewhat, because the trains went faster than the signal system. Go ahead.
So a train designed for 525 being fed 650, I'm rounding out the numbers, ought to hit numbers like, what, 75, 80 miles an hour. Therefore, it exceeded the latency of the signaling system, is what I think you were saying, Bob. To B2AXZ, K2RIW, correct me on that.
No, QSL. They were just going too fast for the block signals, and the speed at which they were going, if the brakes went into emergency, it would take much longer for the train to stop. And on the Williamsburg Bridge, they had a train stopped up ahead, and they couldn't, the brakes were automatically applied, but he was going so fast, he rear-ended the other train.
Yeah, that's not good. I'm sure that potentially did an awful lot of damage to both equipment and a lot of risk to passengers. When it comes to a potential solution, I am guessing that unless DC isolation of the radiacs plus heliacs takes place at each end, you know, a high-pass filter, unless we isolate it, and there's disadvantages of doing that. You really don't want to float that cable, although it could have a separate ground independent of chassis ground, but let's not go there. In order to confirm integrity of grounding, that beautiful article that was shipped to us by Steve, KD2HUC, by the Fluke Company, where if you want to measure the impedance of a grounding system, you've got a piece of, let me pick a number, 2-gauge wire going from cabinet to local station grounding. I'm using those words probably. incorrectly, but you know what I mean. And you got a piece of 2-gauge wire, and you want to make sure it's making a good contact between the cabinet and the ground, by the local ground. By using this pair of Fluke clamp-on ammeter-like devices, where one of them was a signal source, an AC signal, a clamp-on ammeter-like device, and the second one was a sense, clamp-on ammeter device, running at some crazy frequency, 20 hertz, 77 hertz, 140 hertz, some crazy frequency independent of the 720 hertz and the 60 hertz. So you got some crazy frequency that Fluke is locally generating into its clamp-on source and clamp-on sense. And if the Fluke circuit is only looking for that particular frequency and sensing the amount of current, let's assume that it was running at 131 hertz, and it's looking at the 131 hertz signal only and measuring its magnitude of current on the sensing one, I suspect that that system could independently measure the integrity of the grounding wire, measure its surge impedance, so to speak, independent of DC current, leakage current that might be flowing at that time. That's a guess on my part. That's what I think Fluke is trying to tell us with that series of articles that Steve supplied to us. You probably have some opinions on this because I know you've used different kinds of equipment in your grounding integrity measurements in the past, Bob. WA2AXZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, let the meter do what it does. We have this interesting little toy in the powerhouse, and we use this all the time when we wanted to find out the integrity of joints and connections, be it ground, be it rotary converter, solder connections and such. It's a thing called the ductor, D-U-C-T-O-R, not doctor, ductor. Sounds like something from the Marx Brothers. And this is a current-driven meter that tells you down to the micro-ohms, the joints and the cable size, and just about anything you'd want to know about the integrity of a cable and a connection. Pretty much what we've used. We stayed away from the electronics because the electronic meters, the Flukes and such, are just too sensitive, and they pick up stray voltages. When what you're interested in is, you're trying to find out, is the box connected to ground? And again, there's so many different ways of metering it. Fluke can try 10 ways to China with different frequencies. But all Andy wants to do is just ensure that the ground integrity of the case is there. And what he does is, if he uses this machine's ductor, he's telling down to the micro-ohms from the case through the joints to the ground bus what he's got. Now, what the ground bus is connected to, that's another story. That's where he has to talk to the electrolysis and let them scratch their heads if they connected it correctly. Go ahead.
Here, John. Eric recognized. It sounds to me, Bob, like you have a solution to the problem that's being presented to Andy and his consulting firm at this time, that ductor device can confirm to micro-ohms and milli-ohms the grounding integrity of the system grounding that they want to confirm. And it can measure that grounding integrity to micro-ohms and milli-ohms in the presence of leakage currents, DC or AC leakage currents. It sounds to me like the ductor has its own signal that it injects. It's sensitive only to that signal, and therefore it is independent of leakage currents that might simultaneously be present. Is that approximately the great value of the so-called ductor? And what's the brand name of that ductor? Is it an MTA-invented piece of machinery, or is it something of a known brand name like Hewlett-Packard will say? WA2AXZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bob.
All right, there's a great company called Biddle, B-I-D-D-L-E, Biddle. that makes all our high potential test sets and the high current metering and such. So if the explorers biddle, find out what they have in the way to offer in the way of inductor, and they have some modern ones now, but everything still operates on this current process there. I'm sure Andy will have a lot of fun. And again, since he has this thing, it would be interesting to see what my electrolysis group has to say. They have all this stuff. So if we go in and we show him that, yes, you've got a ground or there's a stray current coming in from X or Y, it's just something that we can add to the arsenal for future installations, what we're going to come up against. Good.
Before we go over to Eric, I'm going to make a guess, and that is the leakage current that Andy is being victimized by temporarily right now, it's messing up the measurements that him and his staff or people have to make. That leakage current is giving them grief, and I'm guessing that that leakage current comes from the fact that two stations 2 miles apart, local water pipe ground, is some number of millivolts or fractions of a volt different between station A and station B because of all the things that human beings and Mother Earth is doing to us. Just to give you an example, you can have an extremely well installed set of grounding rods by EIA standards, a number of rods that are 8 feet long, more than a half inch in diameter, copper clad rods rammed into the ground below surface, connected with pieces of a 4-gauge wire. You've got a local grounding system that's grounding your radio tower, for instance. However, let me drop. When Mother Nature comes along with a lightning bolt that happens to strike your broadcast tower and pumps 100,000 amperes into it for the next 20 microseconds, the combination of local resistance and local inductance is such that that 100,000 amperes pumped into the tower, into that grounding system, can lift that grounding system a large number of volts different than you think 0 volts would be, if you know what I mean. If you've got a chunk of electronics that's in that vicinity at that time, I think is the world's best ground, and it could be a great big copper mat of grounding with a whole bunch of rods in the ground, when that lightning bolt comes along, what you think is ground is going to be hundreds and sometimes thousands of volts different and occur. So therefore, earth ground, water pipe ground, and whatever, 2 miles apart, I am guessing there can be all kinds of differences there. Before I send it back to you, Bob, for any further comments on that, I know that Eric wants to say something on all of the above. KE2EJ, K2RIW, he's the guy with the broadcast tower with a super ground that's probably struck with lightning a couple of times per year. That 330-foot tower of yours. KE2EJ, K2RIW, our broadcast engineer. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Oh, that's covering a whole gamut of things. Well, I could go on for a long time, but actually it took us a while to create the grounding system that works well, because we used to blow stuff up every time we had a lightning hit, but we've kind of solved that. And it takes a multiple ground system. By the way, we've used the Biddle stuff, we've used PowerSight, and we've also used Fluke. But the point that I want to make really has to do with Andy and his radiac. I'm curious as to where they make the transition. Andy, assuming you're using 7/8 inch or inch and an eighth radiacs, when you make the transition to the heliacs, are you going through an end connector and then back to another piece of 7/8, or are you using a butt connector that's the same diameter as the radiac? That's the first question. The second question is, have you ever bothered to put a AC-DC amp probe on the outside of the radiac to see if there's actually any current flowing through it? And I bet you darns that there is, and you could measure it. And if you had a ground point, or if you had a difference in potential somewhere along the cable where it's great, if you ran along that cable with the amp probe, you would see the difference in levels. What other drop?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you that Andy has measured as much as 9 amperes of current with a clamp-on ammeter on that heliax that goes to that radiax. and the heliax to radiax, that transition takes place in the tunnel. Is there a type N connector in between as opposed to a bulkhead? I know there's a lot of milliohms of difference. That's what I think you're addressing there, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW. Better wait for the beeps. I'm almost timing this out.
Yes, that's one thing. The other thing is that the cable that they put up for Radiax, I can't imagine that if they bought it from Andrew or CompScope is where you would get it from today, that they made you a spool of cable that's 2 miles long. That's got to be chunks of cable that usually come in, you can get them as big as, 2,000 feet, 2,000 foot reel. Maybe they special ordered a continuous length of cable. But the transition between cable that they use multiple pieces of cable, did it terminate into an N or a DIN connector and then back into the cable? Because in our experience, like at Empire and at the old World Trade Center, that became very problematic. And actually, when I do grounding here, once we're outside the ground system, everything's fed by either 8-inch wide copper or double-aught cables, like at the building at 33rd Street, where we grounded the dish installation on the top. I ran 4 double-aught cables and still wound up with multiple milliohms of difference, which created some other kinds of problems. At Empire, we had, they've got a really wonky electrical system there, where the small amounts of eddy currents on the outside of hardline, now we're not talking on heliox here, we're talking 3- and 8-inch hardline, there it becomes a major problem. So I'm just wondering if we looked at it from that perspective. K2RW, K2EJ.
Let me just interject and answer this question, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric. Andy.
Okay, very good. Thanks. As far as transitioning and where it's located, that depends on the station. As you probably are aware, we have over 300 stations total throughout the system, and no two stations are the same. So I don't know exactly where the transition is taking place. It's not in the room. 90% of the time, it's not in the room that I'm working in. It's outside the room, which could be either in a tunnel or in another room somewhere. That has to be investigated. So I don't know what kind of if they use a bulkhead at that transition point, or if it's just an end connector or what have you. As I said earlier, my understanding is that the radiax throughout the system is not supposed to be grounded at all. It's supposed to be above ground as far as the mounting configuration. There is no place where it is actually touching in any structural ground or any concrete ground or what have you. The stainless steel hangers that keep the cable in place are supposed to be insulated. And as Bob mentioned, if one is has been penetrated, that could cause a problem. Where that is occurring, obviously I don't know. That has to be looked at. And that's when Bob mentioned possibly the use of an infrared camera to measure heat. The only place where these cables are grounded is at the bulkhead at the cabinet itself. And interestingly enough, just as a point, I was measuring the resistance from the bulkhead on top of the cabinet to the ground screw on the same cabinet. So I was going from cabinet...
Repeater, timeout.
Let me get the beep again.
Good thing you're running full duplex, so you know when to time out.
Yeah, I always do. That's all I know. Bob, and this is interesting, and I think I mentioned this to you, I was measuring the resistance from the bulkhead on the cabinet to one of the conduits that are connected to the external power plant or any ground point, any ground screw, and just from the cabinet, so from cabinet to cabinet, only a few feet away, maybe even less than a foot away, I should say, I'm seeing this jumping resistance. So it's telling me like the whole cabinet is lit up, and I'm using that expression, lit up by these stray currents that are floating throughout the cabinet, on the outside of the cabinet. It's, you know, luckily it's not affecting the communication system. You know, that's the good news. But, and we could probably get away with just leaving it the way it is, but out of my own curiosity, I would like to know where this is, how this is getting in, and what the actual current measurement would be. Let me let it drop, and then I'll answer the other question Eric asked.
I have another point for you, Andy.
Okay, I'll just answer your question. As far as measuring the current using a Fluke clamp-on AC-DC current meter, which I happen to have, I did measure current at one location. I only measured one location so far, and I did see a current of, let's say, a resting current of half an amp, and then it was jumping up to 2 amps and 3 amps and 4 amps, and I also paid attention to the trains coming into the station, and I noticed that when a train pulls in to the station, the current would go up while the train was moving. When the train stopped moving and it was in the station, the current would go down. So the movement of the train is definitely affecting the current that I'm measuring, but I don't know if the current is the actual current that I'm measuring on the Heliax cable going to the bulkhead. I can't see 8 amps of current is being measured going into my bulkhead in the cabinet. So it's a stray current. And that's where I think this other equipment, this biddle or what have you, equipment that we would use, would actually tell us the exact current that is actually being induced into the cabinet. That's the point with that. Let me see. Dick, back to you, then pass it to Eric because he has another point.
From what you just said, Andy, I can tell you have some doubts. My faith in a clamp-on ammeter and its method of operation with its built-in Hall effect device and whatever tells me that when a clamp-on ammeter is around an object going through the hole in the clamp-on ammeter, like your Heliax cable did, and if the jaws are thoroughly closed, and if that properly calibrated clamp-on ammeter told you with a train in the station moving, you saw 8 amperes, and you wondered, was there really 8 amperes of quasi-DC current flowing through that Heliax into that cabinet? I say yes, yes, yes. A clamp-on ammeter is a thoroughly shielded device. It tells you only the current that's flowing through the conductor that goes down that hole of the clamp-on ammeter, on the assumption the jaws are thoroughly closed. When the jaws are thoroughly closed, that it's a completely closed magnetic circuit, and in the DC mode of operation, that telling you the current, that really was 8 amperes flowing through that Heliax into that cabinet. That bulkhead itself, let me drop. That bulkhead was screwed down to that cabinet with stainless steel screws so that they don't rust. Stainless steel has got a hell of a lot more resistance than a copper screw would have. The bulkhead was screwed down to the cabinet without somebody scraping away the paint that was on the cabinet. So that bulkhead, somebody drilled a hole for the center conductor of the bulkhead connector to be mounted to the cabinet. I'm guessing when you do further investigation, there's a high probability in my mind that you'll find out he was not ordered to scrape away the paint. Therefore, the bulkhead connector is sitting on top of the paint on that cabinet. It's only being grounded by the 4 stainless steel screws in the corners. That's why you're able to put your digital voltmeter between those screws and measure voltage. And you did do that, or between the bulkhead and the cabinet, and so on. There's really voltage drop across those stainless steel screws because the bulkhead is only being partially grounded because of the paint. That's not necessarily bad, because the bulkhead connector has got coaxial cable on the outside, coaxial cable on the inside. It's a reasonably well RF-shielded device, but DC current-wise, because of current leakages, it's a little bit spooky. Let me drop. I'm about to pass it over to Eric. I'm going to make a guess as to what Eric was addressing before. He wanted to know was the heliax, was the radiax going down to a connector, like a tape and connector, and then back up to heliax again. And if this is the best of all worlds, there would have been a bulkhead connector where the two pieces of heliax joined. If there had to be a splice, because they didn't buy a 5,000-foot reel, if you know what I mean. Or 2 miles would be almost a 10,000-foot reel, which is very difficult to buy. So most likely there is a splice. If this is the best of all worlds, it would have been a bulkhead splice, not coming down to a transition. However, the 8-inch diameter hardline broadcast cables that you had in the World Trade Center, they have very low number of ohms. I am guessing that where your transmitter was on, let's say, the 89th floor, going up to the tower on the top of the building, and local grounding takes place, and because of all kinds of crazy currents flowing through the steel structure of the Empire State Building and or World Trade Center. Let me drop. Because of all kinds of crazy currents flowing through the steel structure itself and voltage drops taking place, I am guessing that if your 8-inch diameter broadcast hardline heliax cable was grounded at the transmitter at the bottom, grounded again at the tower at the top, in both cases grounded to the steel structure, which has voltage drops, I'll bet you you've seen all kinds of crazy currents flowing through that. And you're probably also concerned about if on the radiax went down to a connector and back up again, if they weren't very careful choosing that connector and its interface, there could be dissimilar metals aggravating the problem. Are these some of the things you're concerned with, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ.
Well, that goes to the word tightness. Actually, one of the studios that I used to work at, when we turned all the lights on in all the studios, we were drawing a little over 10,000 amps. And one day I decided to touch the outside of the cabinet where the bus bars were, where it came in, and got whacked really good. And it was discovered there was something like 35 amps running from the top of the cabinet to the bottom of the cabinet, where it was actually connected to ground. And, you know, once we tightened up all the screws, and even the screws on the bus bar, all that went away. But the point that I was trying to get at with Andy, and I made a drop. Oh, and by the way, when we run the hard line through those buildings, they're on hangers. Okay, the reason for the hangers, they got to be able to move a little bit. And they don't necessarily make a good ground, so that adds to the problems that you find. But the point that I want to make to Andy is, let's say you're using a 7/8-inch radiax, and you're going to put a connector on the end of it, and you use a tool that they give you. A lot of these guys, especially local free electricians, for some reason, they don't seem to follow instructions perfectly. I'm not saying that of all of them, but, you know, you do electrical stuff with them, they're wonderful. But being a city of New York, every installation that I've ever put together had to have, especially if the building was under local free jurisdiction, those guys had to do it. And I actually had to remake something like 1,200 connectors because they didn't do them right. But my point is with heliax, after you butt up the end, you're getting to put the connector on. Once you put the sleeve down on the connector, and there are two different types of metal. You're doing copper to what looks like an anodized aluminum or steel kind of thing. Let me let it drop again.
Is it possibly nickel-plated? But go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, they're nickel-plated. If you don't flare the copper and make it sit properly in the connector, you get thousands of milliohms difference between one and the other. And I don't expect in the subway that you have one long continuous piece of cable and you have a series of those connectors. And if they did it right, they would use these mating connectors that look like the type of connector that you put on an end. Instead of it being an end connector on the end, it's the same diameter, and it takes both pieces of heliax and puts them together. Again, if those flares aren't made and they're not tightened with a torque wrench like they're supposed to be tightened, you get all sorts of resistance where you think you've got a really good connection, you expect that you're going to be having a really good ground from one end to the other. Forget it, it's not happening. And I can go through a lot of things where that has actually happened. It's taken people a long time to figure it out because because it's not so obvious. KTRW, K2AJ.
I'll make a comment on that, Dick. Then I have to leave because it's getting late for me.
You've got it, Andy. And we're also getting beyond Bob's bedtime, too. You got it, Andy.
Okay, yeah, it's a quarter to ten. I got to get ready for tomorrow. I have to say, I've seen that before. As you've just mentioned, there's a certain art to putting a connector on a piece of heliax, depending on what kind of heliax and the diameter of it and the kind of connector that we're putting on. And I'm not going to go into mentioning any names of any companies, but there is a flaring tool, like you mentioned, which preps or prepares the end of the cable for the connector to be installed. And I've seen in the past where the connector was not put on correctly. And I will say it wasn't done, you know, not deliberately, but just that it was not making a good ground connection because the flaring tool wasn't used or it wasn't used properly and what have you. So I've seen that. And yes, it's done by, you know, non-RF engineers. And that's why I say there's a certain art and technique to install it. So there was a class, I understand, that was given to the people that would be responsible for installing the connectors, and in this class they were, you know, trained how to do it properly. But sometimes, sometimes it's just not done properly. So I've seen that, to answer the question. All right, with that, I want to thank Bob for giving all his input, a lot of information, and I don't think this is the end of the story at this point. It will be continued if you want to continue it now, Dick, but I have to go because I got to get ready for work tomorrow. So,
Repeater, time out.
Let me get the beep back again.
Don't run.
Somebody said don't run. Don't run, just hide. Okay. There may be another question asked of me. I'm not sure. Dick, back to you. And Bob, again, thank you. And we'll definitely be in touch. And we'll see what the next step is going to be. K2RW, WA2CDO.
One last comment from WA2AXE.
Yeah, I'm about to send it back to you, Bob. Two things I want to say to you. Number one, that beautiful device made by Biddle called a ductor. It's looking for good conduction. That's why they call it ductor. It's looking for milliohms and microohms. There's a similar machine that's looking for good insulation, which is looking for megohms, and they called it a mega. So you got a ductor and a mega, depending on whether you're looking for a known good open circuit or a known good closed circuit. Well, when it comes to those radiax cables transitioning to heliax cable that's then connected to the cabinets, if a high pass filter was put in, an isolator, in other words, the RF energy can flow through, but DC current cannot flow through, you'd have to find some other way of grounding the cable because you wouldn't want the cable to be floating for human safety reasons. But if the cable was DC isolated from the cabinet at the bulkhead by way of a high pass filter, an isolating device that's capacitively coupled, I wonder if Transit ever discussed that possibility when they've measured leakage currents in the past. W2AXZ, and thank you for all this information, Bob. You've been very helpful. K2RIW and TechNet, you've got it, Bob.
All right, WA2AXZ, and this is where Andy has to get in contact with our electrolysis section. Because, and I'm going to tell Andy, you only have a couple of amps coming in, but we've had some magnificent manhole fires due to stray currents eating insulation, eating lead covered cables, eating the copper sheath cables, and you definitely don't want that. There's the potential for a high current flow in those heliacs and the leaky cable and whatever, and you definitely don't want that. So while you're doing the detective work, talk to the gang. They'll come out with all their toys, and we may get a solution one way or the other. Hey, gang, it's been great talking to everybody, and let me just drop it for a second.
Bob, have you ever discussed using an isolator at the cabinet? And I think the answer probably is not yet. Over to you, Bob.
Negative on that, because it's never come up. It's never come up. Talking to Andy was the first time we actually heard this. But when he started describing what he had, it's electrolysis at its best in the subway system then. But again, if anyone wants to take a ride on my old trains, we're out there every Sunday until Christmas. And that's at 2nd Avenue on the F line going to 96th Street on the 2nd Avenue subway. I also work on the side at the Transit Museum, so if you come down, just go down and enjoy the lights, because that's me keeping everything lit. After 40 years of running the power system, I'm fully qualified to change light bulbs. WA2AXE.
A question I got for you, Bob. As a slang, we often call the subway the tube. Particularly where it goes underwater, I suspect it really is a metallic tube. The outer wall is conductive. In some cases, I am guessing. Those hangers that are suspending the heliax cable, are they in turn anchored into a conductive medium? I guess on your part, Bob, to be to AXZ, K2LIW.
Well, depending on the train, Ray, it's hooked up to the structure. And if the structure happens to be grounded, well, it's grounded. If the structure is floating above ground the way it's supposed to be, then any stray currents when the train passes is going to leak through to the structure and make itself evident on the cables. And again, that's if the hangar is compromised. Go ahead.
There's a kind of expanding bolt that's used in concrete. If the wall happened to be concrete and you use an expanding bolt that really is suspending the hangar, then depending on the resistivity of that concrete, that hangar is somewhat insulated. Or is it really screwed into some kind of a conductive structure? I'm asking for a guess on your part, Bob. Each of those thousands of hangers that are suspending the heliax cable, do you think each one of those is... If I put an ohmmeter between them, am I likely to see an open circuit, or am I likely to see milliohms? To B2AXZ for a guess, K2RIW on the TechNet.
If you're in the regular subway where we have the structure, you'll actually find the hangar hard bolted to the structure. In addition, the hangar has a traveler, a suspended wire, that's also part of the cable suspension, and there's a good chance that is connected to the structure too. As for the expansion bolts, if it's in a perfect world and it's in a concrete base, theoretically it's supposed to be infinity. But with the humidity, with the water conditions, don't hold your breath. Go ahead.
Very helpful information, Bob. Let's see if Eric, let's see if Andy's got anything to add. And then one of the people who's been giving us information last week was Steve, KD2HUC. After Andy says a few words, I'm going to go over to Steve. Andy, W2CDL, what is it now? Commercial driver's license. W2Commercial driver's license, K2LIW. Go ahead, Andy.
All right, Dick, you got the call. All right, very good. Well, again, to summarize, this is an issue that was discovered a few weeks ago. And literally, the our electricians were literally pulling their hair out to try to figure out why they thought they had a bare ground in this particular location. But we've now discovered that it is more widespread than first thought, which is not unusual and not really surprising. So we do see this. Bob, I'll be in touch. I'll keep you posted, and we will see what so-called the powers that be have in mind. Because, you know, my particular job is to see what's going on in situations like this, and then it's handed off to other personnel. So we'll see what happens with that. Thanks for your input, Bob, and everyone else. It is an interesting topic, and doesn't come up very often. So with that, I'm going to go and get ready because I have to go to work tomorrow. Thanks again, Bob. Big back to you, WHCDL, and talk to you again.
Yeah, let me repeat one more time, Andy. All of my experience, 45 years of using clamp-on ammeters, tells me that when you properly install and properly calibrate a clamp-on ammeter and you put it around a piece of Heliax, and it the jaws are really closed and it measures 5 amperes, take my word for it, with 99% assurance, 5 amperes of real current is flowing through that outer conductor, at least, of that Heliax cable. That's real. That's not a phony reading. So take your word. Have some faith on that one, Andy. Very little chance that is telling you a lie, if you know what I mean. One of the people who was very helpful on this in the past, because he's worked a lot with Long Island Railroad, which also has thousands of amperes flowing into their cars through the third rail, was Steve, KD2HUC, who's probably sitting there chewing his nails, listening to all this jazz. Go right ahead and tell us anything you want to say, Steve. KD2HUC, Mr. Long Island Railroad, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Got a caveat as far as the clamp-on ammeter goes.
You know of a way that meter, properly installed, properly calibrated in that environment, you know of a way that it can lie to you? Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead, Eric.
No, you got to remember, I work around a lot of all that stuff. I agree with you. Properly conditioned and tuned up clamp-on ammeters, making a good clamp, will pretty much read accurately. But even when you're reading a line, you expose it to RF, it will modulate the reading. One suggestion that I have for Andy is get a clamp-on probe. Hook up to an oscilloscope. When the train rolls into the station, you'll be able to tell what the source is, whether it's DC, whether it's AC, or even if it's RF. And some cheaper amp probes, clamp-on ammeters, are susceptible, the body is susceptible to RF, and it'll make funny readings, even though it's not actually sending the funny reading, so to speak. K2RW, K2EJ.
Hold on, Eric, there's a big difference here. You are a broadcast engineer. You've worked with tens of thousands of watts of broadcast RF energy.
I can take my 5-watt 440 and make stuff a lot of unhappy. And he's working around RF gear, whether you want to think about it or not.
His RF gear is running at milliwatts. You run at tens of thousands of watts. Huge difference in magnitude of RF. Every piece of instrumentation around tens of thousands of RF that you work with, every piece of electronics is suspect. He's working with milliwatts in a shielded cable. It's a shielded
milliwatts.
So it's high number of milliwatts of RF energy inside of a shielded piece of Heliax. I don't think his clamp-on ammeter is seeing very much RF current in that circumstance. Eric, go ahead.
How many watts are the transmitters?
Are you asking me a question? Oh, what was the question, Eric?
How many watts do the transmitters put into the radiax?
And that's a shielded system in your room. It only becomes radiating out in the tunnel where it's Heliax. So how many watts is your transmitter launching into that cable, Andy?
Approximately 25. And it's not RF related, that's for sure. The transmitter's not even transmitting. 25 watts comes out of the cabinet when it's on.
And he's making measurement when the cabinet is not on, Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay. Well, anyway, what I said about the amp probes is true. So doesn't apply to him, but it does apply to a lot of commercial products. And I actually have info that is frequency sensitive. So, you know, look at it however way you want. Some stuff is really good, like, you know, a good Hewlett packet is not the same as an Icoscope, you know?
Agreed. Now, Steve, what do you want to add to all this? When it comes to crazy leakage currents, I am guessing Long Island Railroad, under your experience, has seen all kinds of leakage from time to time. KD2, HUC, K2RIW. Go ahead, Steve. Okay, I assume Steve would be there. He was last week. Alrighty. Once again, thank you very much, Bob, for your information. And maybe we'll discuss this a little bit more next week if you're willing to come back as Andy discovers more of what he's going to discover. Any closing comments, Bob, before we go to the next questioner? W2AXZ for a final, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Alright, AXZ here, and again, we've had some strange stuff. Any system that uses direct current, be it the Long Island Railroad, Metro North, New York Transit, BART, or whatever, has a stray current issue. The older the system, the worse it is, simply because the insulation of certain structures that were built back at the turn of the centuries to be insulated from ground aren't anymore. And I know only too well what stray currents have done to us. I'm going to wish Andy the best. Andy's got all the contact information, and if Andy can give me a call this week or just throw me an email, and we'll try to get back next week. Everybody, have a great week. It's only 20-some-odd days till Christmas. WA2AXZ.
And thank you again, Bob. Glad you came back this week. Okay, Joe is the next person on our list. W2RYY. If we haven't put you to sleep, go right ahead with the subject you'd like to discuss, Joe. K2RYW in the TechNet. And maybe Joe got called away, so temporarily we'll go over to Bill, AC2IS. And hope we haven't put you to sleep, Bill. AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, this is Bill, AC2IS. Still hanging in here. Let's see. So I'm noticing that online there's a lot of information on the Apollo guidance computer, the AGC, that was used in the command module and the lunar lander. But there doesn't seem to be much information on what was controlling the Saturn V rocket itself. I believe that's referred to as the LVDC, the Launch Vehicle Digital Computer. I was wondering if you guys knew anything about that system, or being, you know, knowing your history, maybe you would know what people would know about that system. So that's mainly my question. What sources of information might there be out there? What people might there be out there that would know something about the computer that basically flew the Saturn V itself, which is separate from the Apollo guidance computer? AC2IS.
I think there's a real good chance that Bill, our space expert, WS2N, knows something about that. And if he doesn't, if I know Bill, by next week he will know something about that. Bill, WS2N, it looks like a question in your ballpark. K2RIW, you've got it, Paul.
Okay, very good. This is WS2N. Well, I know the Saturn V had a guidance core, around the whole diameter. From the bottom of the service module, we're connected into the S1B, the equivalent of the final stage. You have the initial booster, and that would separate. But you get up to the final stage, and between that and we're connected to the service module, they have this ring, this collar, that had all the electronics in it to control the Saturn V rocket itself. And I would talk to the computer on board the capsule itself. you know, as far as the boarding system, they actually had wires, two wires running down the whole length of the whole Saturn V rocket. And if there was any kind of a malfunction, something started to separate from one another when it shouldn't, those wires would break, and that would send the signal.